Well, there was a couple of errors I picked up in that little movie, but it was a good introduction. It said that they were going to Eva for their protection, and that really wasn't the case because Eva was where the capital was and the tyrant king was there. They went there because Judson had met a doctor named Dr. Price. And you got to remember the year 1825, actually had some practice in eye surgery, which was very unusual and very much needed in the capital. So they went there for that, but he got mixed up in some business dealings and confused with people from England, and they said that he was a spy and ended up 21 months in two different prisons. The other thing that I think was an error in there was that it says that his after the death of Anne, his faith did not waver. And I can assure you it in fact did, and that's what we'll discuss. But after Burma had been conquered, peace being declared, the Judsons departed and arrived in Rangoon on March 21st, 1826. And he was offered an offer from the English government to come work for them because he was so fluent in both languages. But he refused $3,000 a year and took up his mission work with undaunted courage. His associates had fled, the native church was scattered, and the mission property was destroyed. But he came back to Maumee. Now, a couple of background sketches. Edward Judson on the left in this picture was his son through Sarah Boardman, who became Sarah Judson, who wrote kind of an official biography of Adoniram Judson. He lived until about 1914. He was born in 1844. And on the right, you see the president of Brown University, Francis Whalen, who wrote really the more official biography. This is only one of the two volumes. A lot of this information came when Emily returned to the United States after Adoniram had died. But unless you want to be a Judson scholar, there's way too much technical detail here and a lot of it hard to follow, so it's probably far better for you to read To the Golden Shore. Before proceeding directly to consider Mr. Judson's life and moment, it may be well to describe a peculiar phase of his mental and spiritual experience, which has been termed Guyanism. So, Anne died, and it really, really shook him, but he was willing to go on because they still had the baby. The baby was born when Judson was in prison, and Anne had to put this baby in a cart or carry him back and forth to the prison two miles one way, and it finally took its toll on her health, and she died soon after, and unfortunately when Adoniram was away. And that's where I left off last time when I was teaching on this. But after the baby died, Judson actually went into a time of isolation. He really had that was Courtney Anderson that wrote the book. That's how my mind works. I remember these things, and then when I'm standing before you, I go blank. Courtney Anderson wrote To the Golden Shore, but from the date that is in the second anniversary of the triumph of death over all the hopes of earthly bliss, Judson, writing this 2 years after the death of Anne, said, "I have this day moved into a small cottage, which I have built in the woods away from the haunts of men. It proves a stormy evening and a desolation around me accords with the desolate state of my own mind, where grief for the dear departed combines with sorrow for present sin, and my tears flow at the same time over the forsaken grave of my love and over the loathsome sepulchre of my own heart, October 24th, 1829. He actually dug a makeshift grave, and he would lie down next to it and contemplate his own death. So there was an extended time in which he really was in depression, and he started reading the mystics, the Christian mystics like Madame Guyon and Fenelon, and for whatever reason. But he had received news that his brother Elnathan had died back home. And instead of casting him further down, it actually was the first time that he had something to encourage him, because Elnathan had never received his gospel message to him and was converted right before he had passed away. But in 1831, and that was 1829, in 1831, all of these years of labor and all of this sorrow and pain and everything that he had went through finally resulted in fruit. And I think there was somewhat of a revival that was going on in 1831, because Judson says, a great annual festival is just passed, during which multitudes come from the remotest part of the country to worship at the great Shwa Dagong Pagoda in this place, where it is believed that several real hairs of Gadama are enshrined. During the festival, I have given away nearly 10,000 Bible tracts, giving to none but those who ask. I presume there have been 6,000 applications at the house. So these would have been things that he had already translated into the Burman language. Some come from 2 or 3 months' journey. That's how the word spread about out about how his labors and translations were available. And they came to him and they say, "Sir, we hear that there is an eternal hell. We are afraid of it. Do give us a writing that will tell us how to escape it." Others came from the frontiers of Cathay, 100 miles north of Ava. "Sir, we have seen a writing that tells about an eternal God. Are you the man that gives away such writings? If so, give us one, for we want to know the truth before we die." Others come from the interior of the country, where the name of Jesus Christ is little known. "Are you the Jesus Christ man? Give us a writing that tells us about Jesus Christ." You know, I have numerous references that I've collected over the years on the life of Judson. And there was a magazine that was published in the early 19th century called The Panoplist and Missionary Magazine, and it's kind of fun going through there and finding the references to Judson. This is from the year 1838. I actually have in my library a volume, a first edition, of course, from 1825-26 that details the Judson's coming to India. So it was even published before he had gone to Burma, and this magazine published whatever sources it could find on missionary endeavors. So you think about that being 1826. That's pretty impressive. So in Burma again, Judson again attempted to establish the faith within the gates of the Burma proper. He located at Prome and preached to thousands, but the king, hearing of his work, gave orders for him to depart. So there is a new king in this part of Burma who may have even been more tyrannical. So he reluctantly withdrew to Rangoon, where he remained almost a year. About this time, the mission board urged him to take furlough. But though on the field 18 years without rest, he declined on the ground of the need of the field. He was overjoyed upon returning to Maumain to learn a number of large numbers of Burmans and Karens and Talines had united with the church. 2 million pages of tracts and scriptures had been printed, and a church in the jungle some distance had been organized. Taking a band of native Christians whom he had sent out two by two in every few days, had returned and reported to him, he established systematic tours in the jungle. So there was a great work already going on in Maumain. And so he would like to have gone somewhere else where he could work on his dictionary, but he just wasn't welcome there. And in the history, he had made contact with the Boardmans, who were ministering more to the Corinth people, and he was very, very impressed with their sincerity and so on. But George Borman was already starting to show signs of really becoming sick. And after some time, he did pass away. And because Adoniram had went through this himself, and he knew what Sarah had been going, would be going through, he wrote her a letter. And I was thinking about this morning. I wonder how you delivered letters in Burma. In those days, what kind of a postal service did you have? But somehow she got it, and he, in this letter, just to encourage a sister in Christ who had lost her husband, said to her, "There's very dark days ahead. Embrace God's providence with both of your hands," you know, and there's something to learn in this. But it was 3 years later that he actually corresponded with her and proposed the idea of them getting together. So for 8 years, Judson had toiled alone, but in Mrs. Sarah Hall Boardman, widow of one of his missionary associates, he found a kindred spirit for all his ideals. And on April 10th, 1834, they were united in marriage. She was a widow for 3 years, but had kept up the good work her husband, George Boardman, had so well carried on in Tavoy. She not only dealt with inquirers and directed the mission, but with her child carried by a native, she climbed mountains, forded streams, and threaded forests and marshes in her tour through the jungles to carry the good news to all the people. This lady was a very, very amazing lady, just like Anne was an amazing lady in her own right. But to think of her in this foreign land, and she was exhorted to go back home, but she thought, well, what will happen to these people that I've been instructing if I am to leave here? And so she labored alone and with a baby that she carried through these mountains, streams, and forests, doing the Lord's work among the Corinth people. But nearly 8 years of loneliness had passed since Judson's beloved Anne had died and was buried beneath a hopia tree. He arrived at the age of 46 and then married Mrs. Boardman. He found in her a kindred spirit. She had spent the 3 years of her widowhood in heroic toil among the Corinthians. Just to give you an idea of what this lady was like, if you look at her diary, if you look at her annals. "When I first stood by the grave of my husband, I thought that I must go home with George, but these poor inquiring and Christian Corinthians and the schoolboys and the Burmese Christians would then be left without anyone to instruct them, and the poor stupid Tavoyans would go on in the road to death with no one to warn them of their danger. How then, oh, how can I go? We shall not be separated long. A few more years and we shall all meet in yonder blissful world, where those we love have gone before us." And so for 3 years, this beautiful and intrepid woman continued her husband's work. She was the guiding spirit of the mission. She pointed out the way of life to the Corinth inquirers who came in from the wilderness. She conducted her schools with such tact and ability that when afterward an appropriation was obtained from the English government for schools throughout the provinces, it was expressly stipulated that they should be conducted on the plan of Mrs. Boardman's schools at Tavoy. She even made long missionary tours into the Corinth jungles with her little boy carried by her followers at her side. She climbed the mountain, traversed the marsh, forded the stream, and threaded the forest. Now, soon after their marriage, Mr. and Mrs. Judson were compelled to part with little George Boardman. And that's an interesting thing in and of itself, because this boy is only 6 years old. But because of the beating sun and the tropics, everything in that area, it could often prove fatal for a child to be left alone, under that heat. And so when he had reached the age of six, they actually send him away, and he's taken care of by others. The children of Anglo-Saxon residents in the East have to be sent at an early age toward the setting sun. Otherwise, they are in danger of death under the debilitating influence of the Oriental climate. Or if they get their growth at all, are liable to feebleness of mind and body. Such a separation between parent and child cannot but be peculiarly distressing to the missionary. And I would say the more so in light of you think about how many of Adoniram Judson's children had already died. They lost one child at sea on the way to India. Another boy soon after they got to Burma. And then while he was in prison, they had a baby that Anne had carried back and forth to the prison. And of course, that baby, as I said, had died soon after Anne had died. And now they have this six-year-old child that they have to send away for its own safety. But he continued his labors. They worked together, and I found it very interesting what a command of the Eastern languages Adoniram had when you consider that, unlike other languages, there are no diphthongs. In other words, there's no other languages that were close enough that you could compare them and so on. He had to master this language that he didn't even know when he had gotten to Burma. But after 21 years of patient toil, Judson completed the translation of the Bible into the Burmese on January 31st, 1834. He then took 7 years more to revive his first work, and at last on October 24th, 1840, the entire book was ready for the press. Competent judges pronounce the Judson Bible as the best translation that has appeared in India. And like the Luther Bible, it will probably be the Bible for three centuries to come. It is said to be perfect in its literary cast. Well, to give you an idea how amazing that is, if you ever study the life of William Carey and his associates in India, they had translated at least parts of the Bible into 40 languages. And what's being said here is, as a literary work and translation, it may, for command of the language, exceed anything that was done in India. But you see this, you saw this in Adoniram Judson, this kind of genius, when at the age of 3, he was already able to read a chapter of the Bible to his dad, that he had graduated at the top of his class at Brown University and so on. There was a real genius about him, and God had put him together for this task, but his health began to fail. And when he was 50 years old, after 25 years of incessant toil in Burma, Judson's health began to show signs of giving way. Difficulty in his lungs, attended with great pain and loss of speech, compelling him to take a sea voyage to Calcutta. There weren't 10-day antibiotic regimens. The way you recovered in those days is you got on a boat and you went out to sea and hoped that the salt water in the air would refresh you. He did return better, but at this time, Mrs. Judson also was attacked by a disease that in the end closed her labors. Sarah, I think they had been married 11 years. They together went to Calcutta, then to the Isle of France, and back to Maulmain. On this trip, one of their children died. Mrs. Judson did not improve. All missionary work had to cease, and they determined to go back to America. So this is the first time he even entertained the idea of going back to America in all the years he had been there, now 25, which he thought that he would never do, but for the sake of her health, they were hoping to voyage and then maybe getting back, and they assisting her might save her life. So they left the youngest of their three children behind with missionaries and took the eldest three with them, and they started on the September 1st, 1845. Now you think about it, I'd shown you the picture of his son, Edward Judson, who wrote his biography. That would have been one of the three sons that on the left went with him on this journey. And again, he died in 1914. So while their boat was off of St. Helena, Mrs. Judson passed away. She didn't recover. And Judson was preparing the body for burial, and that afternoon it was carried ashore and buried in the public burial grounds of that rocky island. That evening, the boat lifted anchor for its journey. When I first started studying the life of Adoniram Judson, it was because of a conference sermon that John Piper had done called about how certain people die so hard. And Piper gets to this point in the life of Judson where he buries Sarah, gets on the boat, and they pass away. And he said, "I cried like a baby when I read that. Oh, yeah, she's dead, but you can't just leave her there." But that's the way things were in those days. So they head off to America. He's very, very disconsolate. The three children are crying. And they arrive in October 15th, 1845. And what's unique about this, what's interesting about this, you think about Judson's life, if you know the beginning of it. He had left Brown University as a deist. He sought fame and fortune for himself for a while, went up to New York, and fame and fortune escaped him then. And now that he's coming back to America, the last thing he's looking for is fame and fortune. And he's so well received because in missionary annals, he's already a hero. So he gets to Boston, and he was hardly prepared to meet the wonderful greeting that was awaiting him. He was in delicate health. His pulmonary trouble kept him from speaking above a whisper. He couldn't speak real loud because that climate had taken such a toll upon his lungs. So when he addressed audiences, others had to repeat what he was saying. Of course, they didn't have microphones. So at times he would disappoint audiences by not telling of his labors. But he always wanted to talk about the wonderful story of redeeming love. He found it difficult to frame sentences in the English after so long a time thinking in a foreign tongue. It was difficult for him to speak fluent English again. I always wondered about that because my wife has now been here. We just celebrated our 22nd anniversary 2 days ago. I said, "Are you ever going to get so fluent in the English language that you're going to forget how to speak to people in Spanish?" But I can assure you it hasn't happened yet. Yet in spite of all this, his journey from home to home and city to city was like a triumphal march. Secular and religious papers reported his movements. This guy is not looking for this fame. He's in a state of mourning. He doesn't want all of this fanfare right now. He's a humble man. But this great respect was paid to him. The Sophia Walker, with Mr. Judson and the three children on board, arrived at Boston in 1845. The missionary, who had been so long absent from his native land, felt considerable anxiety before going on shore as to where he should secure suitable lodgings in the city. He little dreamed that every home would be thrown open to him, and that soon his progress from city to city would almost assume the proportions of a triumphal march. He was ill-prepared for such an enthusiastic greeting. He naturally shrank from observation. He was in exceedingly delicate health. His pulmonary difficulty prevented his speaking very loud. That's from the life of Edward Judson that you see on the left. Mr. Judson's movements in this country were chronicled alike by the secular and religious newspapers. His toils and sufferings had made his name a household word among all Christians. I can't even imagine that in our day. I don't care what kind of fame you have as a Christian in our day, unless you're a false prophet, you're not going to get this kind of fanfare from the secular press. But it was a different day in the 1840s. Wherever he went, the churches were crowded with people who desired to see and to hear America's pioneer missionary. Because if you think about it, of the five people that meant to set out to India, Judson is the only one that stayed for an extended time in the foreign mission field. There was another couple who were on the boat with him that died very soon after getting to India. But while on his tour through the country, everywhere kindling missionary enthusiasm, he met during a visit in Philadelphia a young lady, Miss Emily Chubbuck. And she was a fiction writer, but he learned of her fame through writing. She is about half of his age, and he asked her, "Would you be willing to write the biography of Sarah, his wife, who had just passed?" So he meets Emily Chubbuck, who, under the nom de plume of Fanny Forrester, that was her fictitious name, had achieved a wide literary reputation. The acquaintance culminated in marriage. This lady, who was to take the place at a side left successively vacant by Anne Haseltine and Sarah Boardman, had been disciplined in the hard school of poverty. They're having a conversation, and he says to her, before they're engaged, "Would you be willing to sit on the couch? I want to talk to you about something." And of course, she was flattered by that. She knew of his fame and so on. And he said to her, "Why, with the gifts that you have, the mind that you have, would you employ yourself in writing fiction and these type of things that he had read?" And her response really kind of was a rebuke to him, because of her poverty, if she wasn't writing these things, her family, extended family, couldn't even survive, mother and father and so on. So Judson, as it's written here, conducted her to the sofa, saying that he wished to talk with her. She replied half playfully that she should be delighted and honored by having him talk to her. With characteristic impetuosity, he immediately inquired how she could reconcile it with her conscience to employ talent so noble in a species of writing so little useful or spiritual as the sketches which he had read. Emily's heart melted. She replied with seriousness and candor and explained the circumstances which had drawn her into this field of authorship. Indigent parents largely depended on her efforts. Years of laborious teaching, books published with but little profit, had driven her to still new and untried paths, in which at last success unexpectedly opened upon her. Making this employment purely secondary and carefully avoiding everything of doubtful tendency, she could not regard her course as open to serious strictures. It wasn't fair that she was being censored this way by Adoniram. So it was now Judson's turn to be softened. He was humbled by this. It was probably somewhat embarrassing. He admitted the force of his reasons, of her reasons, and that even his own strict standard could not severely censor the direction given to filial love. "I want to take care of my mom and dad. It's a duty, you know." So he opened another subject. He wished to secure a person to prepare a memoir of his recently deceased wife, and it was partly, in fact, that with this purpose that he had sought Emily's acquaintance. She entertained a proposition, and the discussion of this matter naturally threw them much together during the ensuing few days. Mr. Judson and Emily Chubbuck were married in Hamilton, New York, on the 2nd of the following June. But it's America, so even though it's America in the 1840s, tongues are wagging. The marriage was pleasing neither to the literary nor to the religious world. The one thought that the brilliant Fanny Forrester was throwing herself away and marrying an old missionary. He's twice her age at this time. The other feared that the moral grandeur of the missionary cause was compromised by an alliance between its venerable founder, the great Adoniram Judson, they thought, and a writer of fiction. These conflicting opinions made, however, but a slight impression upon Mr. Judson's mind. But why? Because he was far, far too far along in the Christian life to worry about what people were saying behind his back with the kind of labors that he had done in Burma and so on. He wasn't dependent for his happiness and well-being upon the opinion of others. He had long before learned to think that and to act independently. Otherwise, he would never have become a missionary, least of all a Baptist. There is a saying of the story of Judson that I think is worth mentioning at this point. The story of Adoniram Judson this person said, doesn't teach you that a Christian left alone with his Bible becomes a Baptist so much as a Baptist left alone with a Bible becomes a missionary. Baptists really had a history for missions. So they headed back to Burma, 139 days from Boston, and the mountains of Burma appear in the horizon. None ever had a pleasanter passage than we have been favored with, though rather long, from the prevalence of headwinds. So they're back in Burma. He's already lost two of his wives to death. During the 18 months of absence, one of his three children had passed away, and but two lived to greet him. He still longed to enter Burma proper, but the country was now ruled by a king more intolerant than ever. His barbarities and cruelties far exceeded anything known in the land, and the missionary operations, if any, had to be done in greatest secrecy. But Judson had been working on a dictionary, and Rangoon offered facilities that Maumaine did not, and so he located in Rangoon again. During the day, he worked on his dictionary. At night, in his home, he met native Christians who would risk their lives to meet with him. They knew he was there. They wanted his counsel. Still ardently cherished a purpose to enter Burma proper, his eye was upon his old field, Rangoon. To be sure, the new Burman king was a bigoted Buddhist and therefore bitterly opposed to the propagation of the Christian religion. But in Maumaine, there were laborers enough. In other words, there's enough people in Maumaine. I want to go where I have this privacy. He really wanted access to the best books that were in the native language so he could get the absolute best translation of the Bible into their language, because while he was in Rangoon, he would be situated for completing a dictionary, as he would there have access to learned men and also to books not to be found in Maumaine. Also, he hoped that the Burman intolerance might at last yield, and he was eager to press into the interior of the empire and establish a mission in Ava, the scene of his sufferings. So he was diligent. He carried on. And one thing that I found interesting to me as I'm reading the more detailed accounts, and again, I said that would be The Life of Judson by Francis Whalen. And this is just volume two of two volumes. And Edward Judson, and they're really detailed, and I've tried to read a lot of the letters, that he wasn't impressed a lot by some of these missionaries, and partly they got that missionary drive through what they had heard of his own endeavors. But if they weren't coming there to be there for good, to really give their life up for this work, I just noticed in Adoniram there wasn't a lot of hope, maybe even lack charity to those who only wanted to come for a few years and then go back. But after a while, his health, which already was showing signs of failing, when him and Sarah went back to America, and Sarah died, now he's getting worse. So he has to leave Emily behind and the children, and again go out to see if the salt water would refresh him and he could recover. So he's carried on board the French Barque Aristide Marie, bound for the Isle of Bourbon, with the reluctant assent of his friends, his physician having recommended such a voyage as the only possible means of restoration, it being desirable to get to sea as soon as practicable. It is the opinion of most of the mission, one remarked, that you will not recover. I know it is, he replied. And I suppose they think me an old man and imagine it is nothing for one like me to resign a life so full of trials. In other words, well, if it's God's will with the trials I've went through, I'm ready to go. I'll just remind you of one part of that. Probably the most detailed communication. Judson, when he got out of the death prison in Ava, and he had a chance to talk to Whalen, his future biographer. Waylon said, and this is already a number of years afterward, you know, he bore as many as five pairs of fetters in this prison. And if you were here for the first part or have read the story, a bamboo pole would be slipped through the fetters and the prisoners were lifted up at night to where only the head and the back of their shoulders touched the ground, and that's how they had to sleep. That years after, Francis Whalen said he still bore the pain and the crippling effect of wearing those fetters. And then, of course, they had did that death march of some 6 miles from the one prison to the other, where they hadn't walked for an extended length of time, and their feet in the hot sand began to blister, and the blisters would pop, and the pain was so incredible that Judson looked at the river below and probably the Irrawaddy and thought about just casting himself over the side and ending his life. But he just said he couldn't with a clear conscience do that. He had borne so much suffering to get to this point. So that puts an added emphasis on him saying, they imagine it is nothing for one like me to resign a life so full of trials, but I am not old, at least in that sense. You know I am not. Oh, no man ever left this world with more inviting prospects, with brighter hopes or warmer feelings, he repeated, and he burst into tears. But he is in great pain on the ship, and his dying is slow, and that's why Piper's sermon was called How Few They Are Who Die So Hard. These were some of the dying words of Judson. He spoke to the servant in English and also in Burman of Mrs. Judson, bidding him take care of my poor mistress. And at 15 minutes past 4 o'clock, he breathed his last. His death, says Mr. Rainey, was like falling asleep. Not the movement of a muscle was perceptible, and the moment of the going out of life was indicated only by his ceasing to breathe. A gentle pressure of the hand, growing more and more feeble as life waned, showing the peacefulness of the spirit about to take its homeward flight. It was first determined to keep the body until Saturday for burial. In other words, can we get to land and bury him on land? And the people that were piloting this ship, the crew, they weren't at all Christians. So they weren't giving him a Christian burial, just wasn't their priority. But Mr. Rainey was admonished of the necessity of immediate preparations. A strong plank coffin was soon constructed, so they threw together a coffin and they pour several buckets of sand in the bottom of the coffin to make it sink. And at 8 o'clock in the evening, the crew assembled. The larboard port was open and in perfect silence, broken only by the voice of the captain. In other words, now go ahead. All that was left of the mortal Dr. Judson was committed to the deep in latitude 13 degrees north, longitude 93 degrees east, 9 days after their embarkation from Burma. He died April 12, 1850. So if we review what he had accomplished at this time, he was permitted to finish the more difficult part of the Burmese dictionary. The English and Burmese, the Burmese and English were completed by his co-laborer, Mr. Stevens. He wasn't able to finish the dictionary, but had a co-laborer. When evangelizing Burma first formed itself in his mind, he hoped to build up one congregation with 100 converts before he died. At his death, however, Burman and Karen Christians who had publicly been baptized numbered over 7,000, beside the many during the 35 years of service who died happy in the faith. There were 63 congregations established under the direction of 163 missionaries, native pastors, and assistants. This result becomes the more remarkable because it was accomplished in the midst of a people having a literature and religion to be supplanted. His consecration and missions gave occasion for the organization first of the Congregational Mission Board and then the American Baptist Mission Union. But why both? Remember, he set out to India as a Congregationalist. His father was a Congregationalist. In fact, his father had studied under the descendants of Jonathan Edwards. And while he was at sea, and knowing that he was going to meet William Carey, he had studied the subject of baptism and had become a Baptist, and was reluctant to come along. By becoming a Baptist, they were going to lose all of their missionary funding. But word got back eventually to the Baptists, who were really excited that now they had a missionary abroad, and they started a missionary union and raised support for him. But he had a very direct influence and quickening interest, which led the Episcopalians and Methodists and Presbyterians to organize also. The story of his life, and especially his suffering in Ava, shall ever thrill the heart that is touched with suffering for Christ's sake. And his influence for world evangelization will cease only when the great task is completed. So Emily, because of the way the news spread in those days, and she's expecting a child, she couldn't go without an arm, did not even hear finally of his death for 4 months. And she gave birth, and the baby died. So finally, she knew it was time to come home, and she came back to America and already had contacts with Francis Whalen, the president of Brown University, and communicated a great deal to him to do this biography. And I think there's a real irony in the fact that it's Brown University. Last week, and you won't remember this, I was talking about the doctrinal dissertation that I had read when I was teaching on the firing of Jonathan Edwards. I was stirred up by a PhD dissertation from Brown University, 1962. The guy's name was Earl Pope. Well, that was 1962, and Brown University was probably still, at least in name, a Baptist university. Now it's completely theologically bankrupt, and that's happened to so many of our seminaries. But I feel so unworthy to teach on a life like this. What kind of suffering, what kind of self-denial have I shown? And yet that's probably what drew me to this, is I'm drawn to see people who gave up so much for the Master's cause. When Piper was talking about the second prison and the prisoners there, and they're being hung practically upside down at night, and the mosquitoes would come in off of the rice fields and bite them, and they had no way to get rid of them at night. They were in agony. It was really, really some suffering, and why God allows that to happen to his children. And yet he's directing this in the whole time, because so much of the Burman Baptist churches owe their foundation to what this young man did when they set out in 1812. But with that, I'll close, except that I was told to remind you that David Woolen will be sitting in for me next week. We, Lord willing, will be in Emmanuel Baptist Church in Sacramento, and we're invited to the home of Bob and Becky Gonzalez. But David Woolen is going to do an overview of two more of John Bunyan's works, the Life and Death of Mr. Badman and the Holy War, and he asks that you would pray for him. Does anybody want to say anything before I close out in prayer? I thank you guys for your patience. I didn't even figure out until about Tuesday night that this is what I needed to do. With everything going on, Michael's graduation and preparing to go to California tomorrow, and the food drive for the Postal Service yesterday, I realized that I had to do something I was at least pretty familiar with, and that's what took me to part two of the life of Judson.
Tom, the two children survived then?
A couple of survived, yeah. Well, see, because he also had children from Emily that survived, but it's interesting to even be able to see an actual photograph of Edward, because that's the only photograph of one of his children that were born in Burma. And he really put together quite a life of his father. And where that's remarkable, and I didn't mention that, is the difficulty of that whole thing is when he had set his mind to this life of seclusion, built the hut out in the forest, he wrote to his sister and said, I want you to destroy my correspondences. He wrote to Brown University and told him to destroy his honorary doctorate. There's so much of the life of Adoniram Judson that had to be communicated verbally because he had destroyed so much. And he never kept any annals of his time in prison. The reason why we have such good detailed accounts, as I had mentioned before, was from a person who was in prison with him named Henry Gouger. And that book is called 2 Years in a Burman Prison. And you can get it print on demand. I don't think it's in print, but it's really an amazing book to read.